Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 45 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the non-fiction writer John Kay shares his audio diary during a week when he lets go of a completed book and begins to contemplate the next one.
Hello, I'm John Kay, spelt K-E-A-Y, and I've been writing for about 40 years. All non-fiction, mostly books, but at one time journalism and radio as well. I live in the West Highlands, which entails a certain amount of travel in itself, and I go abroad quite a bit, mostly to Asia. Of my 24 books, about half are to do with the East. The shelf behind me is devoted entirely to Kay books, mine, Julia, my late wife's, and Anna, my elder daughter's. This room, which I call my study, was once a gun room. It's long enough to take fully assembled salmon rods, and it's lined throughout with pine, to which age has given a deep chestnut sheen. Pretty well everything I've ever written has been written here. The pine is itself lined with bookshelves. Non-fiction needs an awful lot of books, and not all can be found on the internet. Arabia is over there by the door. Then comes China, Southeast Asia above the radiator, India and Pakistan, and so on. Reference books are just within reach to my right, dictionaries, Roget, Fowler, encyclopedias. Scotland and London, of which we produced our own encyclopedias, occupy the topmost shelf. It runs right round the room, but you need something to stand on to reach it. Also, a duster for the cobwebs. There are two doors. One leads into the rest of the house, and the other offers the option of a loo or a low door to the great outside. A pair of swallows has currently commandeered this entrance, so I'm not using it at the moment. My desk, actually just a work surface, runs the length of the room. It's white, but books, printouts and photocopies tend to accumulate on it, some undisturbed for years. By swiveling my chair, I can address a second-hand computer, a small screen, and a rather grubby keyboard. On the other side, a phone lurks somewhere under the paperwork. It's a landline, because there's no mobile signal here. Julia used to occupy the workstation at the other end of the room. Her place has now been taken by a stack of complimentary copies of her last book. The floor has fitted carpet, except where my chair has worn a hole in it. Dogs and at one time children were forbidden entrance. But not all intrusions can be prevented. A chicken once flew straight through one of the window panes, followed, but not quite, by a skinny fox. Moths, drawn to the angle poise on still summer nights, attempt to repeat the feat. And there's a lot going on behind the panelling. Could be mice, could be wagtails. You're never alone in an old house. This morning, I killed off Colonel Gardner. In the book-writing cycle, this moment of completing one book and gearing up, hopefully, anxiously, for another, doesn't come round very often. Normally, of a morning, I'd roll in, having walked the dog, at about 10 a.m, check emails, and start editing what I'd written the previous night. But today, indeed this week, is not at all typical. The spell has been broken. The magic, such as it was, is over. Gardner, still in his tartan turban, lies stiff on his deathbed. After a bit more tinkering, I must face about, attend to all that's been neglected over the past months, and brave a new world without the comforting certainty of a book at the end of it. It reminds me of Wayang Kulit. If you've ever attended a session of this Javanese shadow puppetry, you'll know what I mean. The show cracks off after dusk. The air is like toffee, thick and heavy and slightly above body temperature. Sitting none too comfortably, you brace yourself for a long night. The music brings stick-like figures jerking onto the screen. An old man declaims in a soporific chant, a story unfolds. Somewhere between sleep and wakefulness, the moon shifts, consciousness and fantasy overlap. You're dreaming, and what you're dreaming is itself a dream. But it's the awakening that comes to mind right now. Overhead, Particles of silvery dust pepper the black of night. The show is winding down. Justice done. Dream over. Tomorrow has arrived. No dew, but definitely a whiff of coffee. You stand and stretch, get your bearings, and stumble off into what's left of the night. That's pretty much where I am this evening in the Highlands. The Colonel is dead. I've been under his spell for a couple of years. Now the spell's broken, and I badly need a new book. More on that, and the Colonel, tomorrow. Hello again. This is John Kay, still in his conker-coloured study in the West Highlands, with one book just finished, and fretting over the next. Actually, the first 24 hours without the Colonel have proved to be not without the Colonel. This morning, the publishers emailed that I was supposed to have filled in what they call an AI, and more crucially, that we need a title. Here in the hills, AI is what you do to cows if you haven't got a bull. It's also short for artificial intelligence and apparently for advance information. In other words, 20 or so bullet points indicating why your book is the greatest ever written, who's meant to read it, and what led you to write it. I hate this self-regarding nonsense, but worse still is choosing a title. The Colonel was an odd assignment from the start. I'd never written a biography before, and anyway, this proved more a biographical quest than a straightforward life. Alexander Horton Campbell Gardner is known, if at all, for his memoirs, which someone else wrote and which in the fact-to-fiction spectrum are usually located somewhere between Baron Munchausen and Marco Polo. In other words, the Colonel was either an appalling liar and scoundrel or the greatest traveller adventurer of all time. Guess which, or better still, buy the book. Another odd thing is that the idea for the book came from a publisher I'd never heard of, and that part of the deal was that they would undertake most of the research. It didn't look too promising, guest writing on a doubtful subject for a dodgy publisher. I did know about Gardner, though. In a book written about 40 years ago, I devoted a chapter to him, but I wasn't convinced either then by Gardner or now by Cashy House. Cashy House proved to be a Sikh with a long beard and a large van. I didn't know there were any Sikh publishers, let alone one whose headquarters was a parking meter behind the British Museum. But at the time, I wanted a quick book, and Mr. Cashy House had a team of researchers at the ready. It seemed worth investigating. Despite some raised eyebrows at the literary agency in Golden Square, the thing went ahead. We thought 6 months and 60,000 words would do it. 2 years and 90,000 words later, it's done, except, that is, for the title. I've no strong feelings about the title. Short would be good and intriguing better. Gardner, who he, was my first thought, but it's too suggestive of Gardner, who cares. We need something more explicit. Alexander Gardner, the great enigma in the tartan turban, is the Cashy House choice, but since the cover will feature the old boy himself, all turban and whiskers, maybe we don't need more turban in the title. A prosier suggestion is Long Separated from the World, The Adventures or Otherwise of Alexander Gardner. We'll see. Titles can be tricky. I've used one that I can never remember myself and another that's invariably misspelled. The next book should be easier. In a chat with my agent, my usual trade publisher, I mentioned a possible subject and they immediately started tossing out titles like there was no tomorrow. All fine, except that I'm having second thoughts about the subject. I'd said I thought his papers, it'll be another biography, would run to about 80 volumes. Then on the train back to Scotland, I read that there are actually 800 volumes. When you come up with an idea for your first book, publishers factor in all the other books you may have within you. When you come up with an idea for your last book, they factor in whether you'll live to finish it. But it's good that the British Library now lets readers use their own cameras for photocopying. I wonder what those Sikhs at Cashy House are planning next. With half a dozen iPads clicking away and the van parked round the corner, who knows? 20 volumes a day? Anything's possible. Now I'm off to take out the dog and shut the gate. There's what sounds like a cricket in the undergrowth by the gate. You only hear it at night, and cicadas being unknown here, I suppose it could be an excited wren or some kind of warbler. If I can catch it with the torch, I'll report back. Good night. Hello out there. This is John K-E-A-Y again, and it's Wednesday night in the Highlands. I'm halfway through a week of doing odds and ends in between putting one book to bed and trying to stir another into life. This morning I made notes for a talk, this evening I made notes for a reprint, and in between I sat around a hospital. So much for the glamorous life of the writer. A year ago I married again. Amanda is not just younger than me, but a lot more youthful. She has a demanding job and once ran half marathons. Then, 6 months into our married life, she got something with the ridiculous name of Good Pastures Syndrome. By the time it was diagnosed, she had lost both kidneys. It is very rare, one in a million, they say, and most of them Maoris. She isn't Maori, and she's been on dialysis ever since. At first it meant 5 hours a day on a machine in the hospital. Now she's progressed to home dialysis, which means a different kind of machine into which she plugs herself each night. It's a bit less disruptive, but the equipment is heavy and her diet is as impossible as ever. You don't necessarily die of kidney failure, but you sure don't live or feel that well. Anyway, the result is that our travelling has been restricted. The first outing was to Hay on Wye a month ago. Having little choice because of all the gear, we drove 1,000 miles there and back, and all for a talk and a chance to sell a few books. We've done a lot of book festivals in the last 18 months. We started at Dartington, working our way up through Cheltenham, London, Henley and Edinburgh to Stornoway, then Bombay, after which Amanda got ill and I made a quick dash to Karachi. Now, with Hay over, there's just Chalk Valley History Festival on Saturday. Again, we'll drive, though Chalk Valley is even further than Hay. I'm not on till 9 p.m. It'll mean another early start with possible dialysing on the M6, and no one's going to stay on afterwards to buy books. Actually, I don't think book festivals are really about selling books. They're more about making authors feel important while reassuring their readers that they are important. We're being showcased, dusted down and given a bit of exposure, like the clothes in a charity shop window. The people who've read us are pleased to see us there, and we do our best to pretend that a writer's life really is glamorous. I put on something artfully crumpled. Amanda acts the literary wag, looking sensational and feeling like death, as you do with a foot of plastic tubing trailing from your abdomen and a diet that's more pills than food. The event is a two-header. Andy Duff talks about his book on Sikkim, and I talk about its wider context on the basis of my Midnight's Descendants. We did this at Hay, and it worked pretty well, but Chalk Valley have changed the title to the Sino-Indian Contest for the Himalayas, so we have to include China as well, and Nepal, Kashmir and Bhutan. It could be a late night. Midnight's Descendants is a contemporary history because it covers more or less the period of my own life. But on the whole, I'd advise against contemporary history. By the time it's published, it's no longer contemporary and becomes even less so with each passing month. Either it goes out of print or you're endlessly having to update it. The beauty of writing remoter history is that it doesn't date. My History of the East India Company has been in print for 25 years and is still spared the limbo of print on demand. That's where Sowing the Wind, the seeds of conflict in the Middle East, has long languished. This evening's task was to reread it for the Folio Society. This is the third time the Folio Society have reissued one of my titles, and I'm delighted. Financially, it's not a big deal. What is? But you end up with copies to be proud of, each boxed with gold blocking on the stiffest of covers, and the text so beautifully set that you can't not want to read it. Facts are carefully checked, new illustrations found, and usually there's a silk ribbon as a marker. They also smell good. One was a history of the spice route, and I swear I can still detect a whiff of cinnamon emanating from the high-quality paper. I'm told the second-hand value of Folio Society books is not great, but if I had one bookish wish, it would be to see all K titles on the shelf reserved for Folio editions. With which happy thought, good night from this Highland podcaster. Hello again, John Kay here, casting his pod from a still chaotic desk in the West Highlands. I failed to update you about the cricket-like clicking coming from the undergrowth by the gate in the deer fence. It's still there, but only ever at night. Whatever it is, it's small and impossible to locate. Lest I was imagining it, I changed the batteries in my hearing aid as well as in the torch. To no avail. An owl was calling from the tree above, the dog sniffed out a hedgehog, and I trod on a frog. People sometimes complain that this place is much too dark and quiet. It's never quiet, and this time of year it's dark for barely 4 hours. Owls have to make the most of them, and likewise, presumably, the mystery clicker. The working day began as usual with the inbox. Authors are now more accessible than ever. Even the not-at-all-famous author can easily spend his entire working life doing nothing but field unsolicited emails. Living 2 miles from the road and halfway up a mountain proves no more isolated than a high-rise in Tower Hamlets. I weed out the scams and the spams, delete the request to be linked in with somebody, and respond to anything from friends and family. Then I focus on what's left. Some are regulars. There's Li Qiang. "Call me LQ," he says, who's Chinese but often on the move. We'll meet him next month at Nice Airport. He'll be on his way from Geneva to New York, and we'll be checking in Amanda's dialysis equipment after a short visit to friends. LQ has been trying to get China a History published in a Chinese edition and has started what he calls a Global History Club. Apparently I'm an honorary founder member. For someone who wrote a 5,000-year narrative of the country, I'm actually rather ignorant of China. I'd like to see more. Maybe his Global History Club will run to a ticket. Then there's Radovan. When not masterminding the Bulgarian economy, Rado is a filmmaker, and he too gets around. Last year he popped up in Edinburgh and wanted to meet. I suggested a pub near Waverley Station. When I got there, he'd already set up a camera at one end of the bar and launched straight into an in-depth interview on someone I could barely remember having ever written about. I bought him a book, which proved to be the wrong one, and accepted the character he wants to make a film about is a boy who got left in China by the 1794 McCartney mission. I could recall nothing at all of relevance. The film, he says, is now being scripted. Not, I trust, on the basis of that interview. Quite a few emails are genealogical. If you write a history of anywhere, you can be pretty sure to hear from people whose ancestral researches have hit a brick wall there. As with Rado, I invariably disappoint them. They forget that, of a book you wrote some 20 years ago, you know no more than them. If they're planning to write something, I try to point them in the right direction, and if they've actually written something, I have a quick read. Sometimes they send a copy when it's published. I have half a shelf of these. There's a colourful little volume on the churches of St. Paul in Asia Minor, something called Food at Sea, with recipes for lobscouse and duff, and a very handsome American edition of Grotius's Law of the Sea. The publishers used a map from one of my books. Occasionally they send a little cheque. Best of all are emails from total strangers who say they liked a particular title. In some, a barb or two may lurk within the bait, but I gulp them down regardless. At least they've read the book. Others are just plain complimentary. These are the ones that really make my day. I answer immediately and rate them higher even than press reviews. After all, they aren't being paid, they aren't seeking publicity, and they aren't posting on Amazon from Bangladesh. If any of you dear emailers happens to hear this podcast, thank you. Authors choose solitude. It's the blank screen on which we write, the dark undergrowth in which we lurk. We too click away in the night and don't mind being inconspicuous. But an occasional beam of appreciation can lighten even the darkness of the soul. It dispels the never-too-distant doubts, and it calls for coffee. So cheers. Good evening from Edinburgh. It's Friday, and this is John Kay, a writer of non-fiction, who's no longer at his desk in the Highlands. This is the spare room in Amanda's flat in Coothie, Morningside, the idea being to steal a few miles from tomorrow's drive down to Wiltshire and the Chalk Valley History Festival. I have a laptop here and a few books. Because Amanda has to be within easy reach of the Royal Infirmary, she's mostly here. I come and go. 2 hours' drive from my chestnut panelling and its accumulation of literary leaf mould, I thought writing here would be tricky. But not so. In fact, escaping from the books and the cobwebs, from the grass that needs mowing, and the garden that's reverting to hillside, is quite emancipating. This morning, I cut short the emails, there were only two, and began sizing up the next project. I mentioned it might be another biography, but that I was deterred by the discovery that the subject's papers ran to 800 volumes. Now I'm thinking of it more as history. After all, it's 18th century, and I know how to tackle histories. The more voluminous the state papers, the less they're worth. You pose a few relevant questions. You consult the calendars, which are not the sort you hang on the wall, but handy summaries of official papers compiled by archivists. And then you give yourself a week in the records and go for just what's relevant. Academics wouldn't approve, but that's fine. I write and I speak, but I don't teach. I'm not even quite sure what a peer review is. History, to my mind, is literature, not modern studies. It's not meant to showcase your research. It's meant to engage the reader. Mahatma Gandhi once complained that the trouble with Englishmen, in which he included Scots, was that they were forever writing other people's history. They pretended to an omniscience that properly belonged to God, he said, and expected lesser mortals to bow down and lord their pontifications. Now, writing other people's history is pretty much what I've been doing ever since the 1980s. No one bows down, I try never to pontificate, and it keeps me busy. And in a sense, surely, all history is someone else's. The centuries separate author and subject, just as the continents do. What Gandhi was bitching about was not Englishmen writing history, but historians writing it. There was too much about kings and conflicts, and not enough about culture and the common man, he thought. Too much state papers, in other words, and not enough observation and social awareness. To which I would add, good writing. Very few of the historians we revere, I'm thinking Gibbon, Carlyle, Macaulay, were what we now understand by the term historian. They were writers, and what they wrote was loved as literature. Presumptuous as it sounds, I'd like to write like them, though perhaps in a less wordy idiom and for a wider audience. The subject I have in mind, forgive this anonymity, but you can never be too careful with a forthcoming book, the subject I have in mind was no mean writer himself. I want to do him justice. So I've been working on a proposal, or really a proposal for a proposal. The subject's not fashionable, and times are still hard. I reckon the chances of it going ahead are no better than 50-50. They say you're only as good as your last book, and I'm not sure my last book was good. On average, 1 book in 10 sells well, while 3 books in 10 sell not at all. In my case, there's no progression, and the flops, too, have their fans. A book on cattle droving in the Highlands never even made it into paperback. But on Amazon, I see the price of an unused copy now starts at £581. Unfortunately, I've only got one copy left. Tomorrow, with dodgy shock absorbers and half a ton of dialysis gear, we hit the road at 7. I must turn in. It's been a week in the life of a writer with almost no writing. Some weeks are like that. But thanks for listening. And remember, John Kay, spelt K-E-A-Y. Goodbye.
That was John Kay. You can find out more about John on his website at www.johnkay.com. That's Kay spelled K-E-A-Y. And that concludes episode 45, which was recorded by John Kay and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 46, we feature the second part of Carol Ange's interview with the non-fiction writer Kate Cahoon. Here, Kate talks with Carol about the workaholic Joseph Paxton's parental regrets, the pros and cons of British cooking, and holding the basket of domesticity while ideas float away like untethered balloons. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.